Aloha, everybody. I'm Tom,
Aloha,
and I'm
Tom.
an addict. Did you say Tom L? It's Tom M.
Tom M. Did I? What did I say? Tom L? I'm so sorry.
And not to be confused with Tom C, who's my sponsor, and everybody always confuses us. But me and Tom used together and got clean together, and I actually got more clean time than him. And I pull rank on him all the time just because of that. But he's my sponsor, and I'm very grateful to him. This is exciting, man. It's really exciting. You know, I try to scroll through the people that are on, and you know, I mean, there's so many people I love, and so many people that I know love me and my wife, and a lot of you probably have heard a little bit about what's going on with us. But for you that haven't, I'll just be real brief. My wife's been dealing with lung cancer, and we went to get a CT scan, and they thought the cancer had been spreading up into her lungs. And then the next day they come back and said, well, no, it actually is, that's not the the cancer. That's the COVID-19. And your wife is just diagnosed positive for the coronavirus. And then, so they tested me, and then I also got tested positive to the virus. So I'm 73, she's 70, she's got lung cancer, I got asthma. It don't look good, man. It don't look good at all. So we decided, if we were going to go, we wanted to go together. We weren't going to go to a hospital, and we'll just take care of each other's until we can, and we brought hospice in, and get set up. And on top of that, after finding out we're both tested positive, we hear these alarms going off, and there's a tsunami heading our way, and we're right down by the ocean. So, it's like, okay, God, this is really an adventure, I guess. Well, the tsunami was called off, but here we are. So all odds against us being alive today, but here we are. We've both been cleared of the virus. I tell you, I don't know how, because of our condition. But anyways, I'm going to get into the history of NA. We've been blessed by the grace of God, obviously. I'll get into a little bit about my history. My recovery is, I joke around sometimes saying it's not conference approved recovery. I got out of a maximum security mental institution in California after being in and out of jails for years, and couldn't stop using. My sponsor Tom C had just come back from Hawaii and told me, we talked about Hawaii, and I decided I'm going to go to Hawaii. I was strung out again and couldn't stop. And he said if he were to go to Hawaii, you should look up this lady. Her name was Flo Bird. She was an alcoholic, and she was, a real spiritual, and all the hippies liked her. This is 1968. I got on the plane, and I went, and I landed at the airport at nighttime, and somehow made my way out to the North Shore of Oahu, where he said to go. He said, that's where all the hippies are. And I slept on the beach and woke up in the morning and with $40 in my pocket and a one-way ticket. And looked at this beautiful, beautiful Hawaii. I'm sitting there on this beach alone. There's nobody else on the beach. And suddenly, the reality hit me, like, what in the fuck are you doing in Hawaii, man? Jesus, you don't know nobody. You ain't got no money. You couldn't go back right now if you even wanted to. So, and then I'm sitting there, and I seen this little car pull up. And out of the car comes this lady. And nobody else on the beach. And I recognized the woman from the photos my friend had showed me. This was that lady, Flo Bird. And I walked up to her and talked to her for a little bit, and she just smiled and said, well, put your things in my car and we'll come on back to the house. And it turns out this woman was the only person in Hawaii helping addicts. She was an AA member, and she opened up her doors, you know, for addicts. There was a couple of people there at the house, and I remember when we first sat down, she told me her story, and I identified for the first time in my life. Not so much because drinking was never a big deal in my life. I always was slamming dope. But I identified with the hopelessness and the futility and the powerlessness and just totally being a lost human being, you know, on this planet. But I seen something in her eyes, you know, and something about her. And I knew, you know, this woman was free. If I could get what she's got, man, I can make it in this world. As if I always knew it. You know, and I remember once in LA, you know, hearing Pepe speak, you know, and Pepe said that. He says, you know, I always knew since I was a little kid, I just didn't have what it took to make it in this world. And I wasn't going to make it. It was always going to end bad for me. And when I seen this woman and I knew that she had found something, I said, man, if I could get what she's got, I know I can make it. And she, you know, laid out the 12 steps to me. She gave me a little copy of the little white book. She says, you know, there is a program in California. It's called Narcotics Anonymous. It's very small. As Mel was saying, you know, it was basically, it was, you know, less than 20 known meetings in the world. We were so small, we didn't even know we were small, I guess. But she said, you know, that there's a little group of them, you know, in Southern California. So I stayed clean, you know, for 7.5 months. And then, I went back to California. I guess I had to go back to the scene of the crime, so to speak. You know, I lived in Venice, California. And as soon as I got there, the first thing I did was find the Narcotics Anonymous meeting. It was up in that Moorpark meeting. I don't think Jimmy was there, but, you know, a lot of the old characters, the Magdalenas were there, and maybe even Mel, you might have even been there. That was my beginning, you know, and I've stuck close to NA ever since. Eventually come back to Hawaii and started, you know, helped start the meetings in Hawaii. My first sponsor was Bob Barrett. I thought I was supposed to pick somebody that I was afraid of. So I was afraid of Bob. And I remember, you know, when I asked him to be my sponsor, you know, he goes, yeah, man, you know, that's fine with me, man. And so I said, well, I got my 4-step ready. And he goes, what the hell? When did you start doing that? I said, well, I've been clean 7 months. And he goes, okay. And I said, you know, so how do we do this 5th step? He goes, well, I didn't have a car. So he said, I'll come out to Venice. You know, he lived in East LA. And he came to my, you know, this little house I had. And I hand him my 4-step and he pushes it back at me. And he says, no, you read it. Oh, but, you know, this is one of these 4 steps, you know, that's all that stuff in there, you know, you never want to tell nobody about, you know, it's like, if I tell you this, I'm going to have to kill you, you know, kind of 4-step. And he had me read it, you know, I read it, you know, about 2.5 hours. It was a lot of stuff in there. And all the time, Bob was just going, okay, that sounds good to me, man. Okay. When I was all finished, he smiles, says, real good, Tom. I'll see you at a meeting. And he left. And I thought, fuck, man. I'm really messed up, man. This guy had nothing. He never even said, hey, you know, don't worry about that shit. You know, I've seen worse than that. I've done worse than that. But I remember picking up the books. In fact, of course, back then it was just the AA books. And I remember reading, saying, admit to God, yourself, another human being, the exact nature of your wrongs. And I thought, well, I guess I did it. It was God. It was him. And myself, you know, and back then, you know, that's, you know, we didn't have any tools, you know, for working the 12 steps, you know, you know, we didn't have step working guides, which to me, the step working guide is a sponsor's nightmare. This is my opinion. We believe that, you know, you get right to the heart of the steps, take the step, you know, don't answer questions. Just take the step, get to the heart of it. This woman Flobert, you know, she had me, right from the very beginning, my first week clean, she had me working the steps. She walked into the room one morning, she said, in the living room, she says, look it, I want you to write down all your fears on this piece of paper. And I said, well, I don't have any fears. And she goes, yeah, well, remember the other night, the centipede crawled across the living room, you jumped up on the couch. And I said, yeah, it was a centipede. She goes, yeah, write down centipedes. So I wrote down centipedes, dogs, sharks. And I said, hey, I get it. Yeah, you know, she left. And I was the 80-something fears. And I realized, you know what, I'm afraid of everything. And this was my first look at myself. This is what makes me tick. I'm full of fear, man. I operate out of fear. So, but she had this philosophy that, you know, that the 12 steps were like an antidote to a poison that we have in our systems that it could kill us any minute. You know, how quickly do you want to take the antidote? And so she pushed me into the steps really quickly. And I'm so grateful she did, because, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, a lot of clean time have never worked the 12 steps, you know, and for a lot of you, it shows, you know, because they have resentments they can't get rid of, you know, they hang on to it for years and years and years, and nothing changes. But my early, aside from, being a part of, starting the fellowship here in Hawaii, I also had, contacts with Japan. You know, we had a guy come here and he came to my house and wanted to know how to start, NA in Japan. You know, he didn't speak English or anything, so we had a translator. But, you know, so we gave him everything we had and he went back to Japan. Later, the fellowship here in Hawaii elected me to be their first regional representative to the World Service Conference. So I went to LA to represent Hawaii, and which blew me away, because, man, I just didn't realize how big the fellowship had grown. You know, this was 1983-84, and I just couldn't believe how big we had grown. For a lot of you people who are new and come into the rooms, you know, NA just didn't happen. It took a lot of leadership. It took a lot of people dedicating their lives to carrying this message, to keeping the doors open. You know, it really did. You know, it just didn't happen. You know, I got clean 20 meetings in the world today. What, we got 63,000 meetings on every continent. Yeah, it didn't just happen, man. It takes a lot of people dedicated to making this thing, go. So anyways, I went to that conference and I came back the following year. I thought that would be the end of it, and they elected me to the board of trustees. And back then because the fellowship was starting to grow around the world, they put me on this committee called the International Affairs Committee. I remember when they put me on this committee, they said, "Okay, Tom, you live in Hawaii, so you have Asia." I said, "Oh yeah, I got Asia." And they go, "Yeah." And they go, I said, "So do I have any staff? Do I have any money?" And they go, "No, but you got Asia, man. So what the fuck, man? I got Asia." But you know, God works in strange ways, man. Get contacted by the Japanese. You know, the Japanese was starting to grow there, started getting involved with some international conferences. Just got all God shots the way these things came about. And we started going to, and so I got invited to, I always tell this story because it's people enjoy it. I got invited to go to Japan, and I went to the office, World Service office. I said, "Look, the Japanese keep inviting me." And they said, "Well, we don't have enough money to send you." I said, "Well, I'll go. I'll get there somehow." So I went to Japan. And they asked me at the office, "Before you go, find out how the Japanese translate the God stuff." And I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll try." So I get there, the Japanese meet me at the airport. They bring me to my hotel. The following day, they pick me up and take me around Tokyo, and we're in the subways and all that stuff. And I come back to the hotel that night, and it's about six or seven Japanese NA members with me. And the hotel staff says, "Oh, Mr. McCall, your passport. You lost your passport in the subway." And fortunately, I had put my receipt to the hotel in the passport. Somebody had found it. And the Japanese would consider finding something important like that and returning it to you an honor. So they said, "We have your passport." And just at that moment, the six, seven Japanese members that were with me said, "Ah, Tom, higher power." And I went, "What the fuck, man?" And And then the next day we're going around Tokyo and I see these shops, these they're called pachinko. They're like a combination of, you know, they're gambling, they're pinball machines and slot machines. And I kept saying, what are these things? And they said, and so they bring me in, set me up. I start playing. I'm winning like crazy. I had no idea what the hell I'm doing, but I'm winning like crazy. And the Japanese member said, ah, Tom, higher power strong in you, you know? And all of a sudden I got it, man. I said, you know what? These guys got exactly what we all got. We don't know what the fuck we got. All we know is for the first time in our lives, there's something working for us. Call it God, call it Muhammad, call it Jesus, call it Buddha, you know, call it your doorknob. It doesn't make any difference, man. Something is working in our lives for the first time, and which is making it as possible, you know, not only to live without drugs, but to be free. And so, you know, I've since been all over the world. Spent, you know, a couple times in Iran as that fellowship was growing there. And I can tell you, it's absolutely phenomenal what's going on there. Beautiful, beautiful people. They do things different, you know. I was invited to, I was with a team from NA World Services, and we were invited to a 12-step party. And I thought, what the hell is a 12-step party? But when we get there, there's a big room full of people. There's maybe 13 or 14 guys sitting on the floor, and right across from them, there's 13 or 14 guys sitting there with bouquet of flowers in their hand. And each person was completing their 12-step for the first time, and their sponsor was sitting across from them. And as they finished their 12-step, the sponsor would get up and give them the bouquet of flowers, and everybody would be applauding. And I thought, wow, man, these guys put more emphasis on completing the 12 steps for the first time than they do on milestones of recovery. And I said, man, you know, they got it right, man. They got it right, you know. And I've seen stuff like that, you know, all over the world, different ways people express their gratitude and the way they work their programs and stuff. You know, I always love to talk about the membership, the members in Nepal. Some of the most beautiful, humble, you know, NA members I've ever met in my life, you know. When they pass around the basket, what they do is they pull a coin out of their purse, and they don't have much money there. And they take that coin and they put it on their forehead, and then they put it to their lips, and they put it to their heart. And they repeat it one more time, and then they put the coin in the purse. And that coin is, you know, an offering to the addict who still suffers. And I'll tell you, someone steals that purse, you better head for the Himalayas, because they're going to kick your ass. But yeah, you know, and you know, after that earthquake there, you know, it was amazing, you know, what they did. They, you know, the groups lost their homes, you know, they lost their meeting places. And what they did, they got all their trucks together and they piled them full of, you know, water and medical supplies and tents and tarps, and went up into the mountains to the villages that weren't going to get help. And that's how they served their communities. These are NA members. And I'm sure there's many, 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 many stories like that all over our fellowship. You know, this is, you know, we learn to be of love and service, you know, not only just in our own communities and our own families, but, you know, to the world. You know, this woman, Flaubert, was pushed that at us so hard. Me and there's a whole group of us. She had a group. A meeting at her house. It was called the Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Traveling Group. And she traveled all over the world. Maybe that's how I got this travel thing going on. But she traveled all over the world, and people like me would come out of the bushes and boom, you know, they got it. You know, they got this message, you know, they got this hope, this freedom. You know, I'm looking at the lineup of people that are going to be sharing. You know, it's just you guys did a great job setting this up. I know this; it was a lot of stress and work behind it, because you know you didn't know how it's going to come off. You know, these you never know. You know how these technology things have come off, but you guys did a great job, and thank you so much for being a service like this. You know, there's a whole different world right now, of course, with this coronavirus. It reminds me of a story. You know, this is a Zen story. You know, and some of you might appreciate it. I used to tell it years and years ago, and then I just kind of just the other night I just kind of remembered, you know, how significant the story was to me. But what it was a story of a man or a woman going up through the mountains, and they're having it's a beautiful day, and he's walking along, or she's walking along, and you know, just taking in God all around her and him, and suddenly they hear this noise. He hears this noise, and they look, and it's a giant grizzly bear comes out of the bushes, and it looks at him and starts to charge. And so the guy runs like crazy. He's running, and suddenly he runs to this cliff and looks, and here comes the grizzly. He has no choice. He's got to jump. He jumps, and he goes down about 15 feet, and there's a branch sticking out. And he reaches, and he grabs the branch, and he's hanging on to it. And the grizzly is looking down at him, and he looks down below him to try to negotiate how he's going to get down to the bottom, which is another 20 feet. And here comes a hungry mountain lion, and he starts circling around, looking up at him. And so you might say the bear would represent his past, and the mountain lion would represent his future. But or you could say the bear represents the corona virus, and the lion down there represents what's going to happen after this shit's all over with, man. You know, and we got to go to work, if we even have work, or we have jobs, or you know, the world has changed. But the branch, he's hanging onto the branch, and he hears this noise above him, and it's a little gopher, and he comes out and he starts chewing on the branch. So this is his present, his here and now. So as he's hanging there with the grizzly bear, the lion, and the gopher, all of a sudden he looks off to his left and he sees this little bush. And in the bush, it's a strawberry bush, and it's a beautiful ripe strawberry there. So he reaches over and he pulls the strawberry and he eats it. So the story, the moral to the story, or the metaphor is about this. We can't change the past, you know, and we can't do anything about the future. And you know, right now, there's nothing we can do about the here and now. But there are strawberries in our life. There's beautiful things. There's our families. There's the fellowship. There's the people that we love. You know, there's all this good stuff. Don't ignore it. You know, pick the strawberry. Eat it. Focus on it. You know, God only knows what's going to happen. The hunter could come along and chase away the mountain lion. Have faith. You know, we got to have faith, you know, that, you know, God didn't take us this far for nothing, man. Mel and Norm both, you know, talk so much about, you know, they talked about 12 step work, which is, you know, in a way it's sort of, you know, a lost art in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, we back in the 80s, as all the treatment programs started coming, you know, around, that, you know, more and more people would get the message, you know, not necessarily the NA message, but they would get a message, you know, through treatment programs. And I think we got lazy, you know, we let that happen. You know, somebody will call Narcotics Anonymous and we'll get them set up at the treatment center. And whereas, you know, back in the days, you know, when, you know, Mel and Norm and, you know, and a lot of these other people that are on this list, they're going to be speaking today, will tell you, you know, we did 12 step work. You know, we brought them home to our homes. You know, we went to their houses, we met them places, and we sat with them. We traded them off to another NA member to make sure they got to a meeting. And, you know, we got fully involved. And, you know, and these early members, they would get the message back then. It was like their big aha moment was from another addict. Whereas a lot of them nowadays might get their aha meeting to a treatment center. And so naturally their gratitude is towards that treatment center for saving their lives. So that's why we have such a hard time getting people to, you know, to be so dedicated to NA, you know, because they don't necessarily agree that NA saved their life, you know. So some of these 12-step calls, I mean, there were some amazing experiences, you know, and all these guys could tell you, you know, and girls, you know, they could tell you about what amazing 12-step experiences we have had. I'll tell you one quick one. This is before NA got really started in Hawaii. I put my name in the AA hotline because whenever somebody who had a drug problem would call, they would then send you know, the message to me, you know, and to talk to them. But they never, you know, they never had me go on a 12-step club because they didn't want me, you know, messing with any of their drunks. You know, so I was, you know, I was the dope addict, you know. And one day I get a call. There was some woman had been calling their hotline, you know, for hours and hours, and they couldn't get anybody on my side of the island to go. So I decided I would, you know, so they asked me if I would go. So I go. I had to take the bus to get there, and I walk in front of this home. It's an exclusive neighborhood, very rich, you know, wealthy homes. And, you know, I'm like a long-haired hippie, you know, and skinny. And, you know, and I get to the outside of the house, and I hear this noise, this raging voice and furniture breaking. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I go in there, I'm going to get my ass kicked. I know it. You know, I had an alcoholic father who used to beat my ass all the time. And, you know, and drunken rages. And, but I got this thing, you know, like, okay, but, you know, if you go on such an errand, you know, God will protect you. And I said, okay, well, here we go, man. So I knocked on the door. This little Korean lady opens the door, and she brings me in. And I look in the living room. There's this guy, you know, he's got to be like 6'2", 6'3", about 250 pounds, raging voice. You know, I look across the living room. There's three little kids hiding behind the couch. And he's raging at them. He's threw a lamp at them. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I got to get this guy out of this house, man. You know, so I convinced him to come with me, and I bring him home to my house. I had just gotten married, and walked on the door. And he tells me, hey, I think I'm going to get sick. I'll go into the DTs. We had no detox centers in Hawaii back then. So I told my wife, you know, he'll stay with us. Well, you know, we'll get him through this, you know. And in the middle of the night, I hear all this commotion, and I jump out of my bed and ran out the living room, and I seen this guy running across the living room, and the guy that we had brought to our house chasing him, and the guy jumps out the window, and I said, "What's going on?" He says, "Oh, I thought I was hallucinating, man." I looked up and there's some guy climbing through the window, you know. So we were being burglarized that night, and had this guy not been on our couch, you know, who knows what would have happened. I lost touch with this guy. You know, years later, I get a call from the NA hotline, and they said, "Tom, we got a guy that, you know, that wants help. He just got out of prison." So I talked to the guy, and he says, "Yeah, I'm climbing the walls, man. I want to use so bad." He says, "But if I do, I go back into the joint." So I we arranged a place to meet him, you know, and I came and I picked him up that night, and, you know, to take him to a meeting. And as we're driving down the street, and I said, "You know, it's funny. The last time I was in this neighborhood, you know, it was about 16 and 17 years ago, I did a 12-step call like this." And as we're driving along, I said, "Matter of fact, it was that house right there." And the guy looks at me and he goes, "That house right there?" Yeah, he says, "Was the guy named Gene?" I said, "Yeah, it was Gene, man." Because, yeah, that's my father. You know, he was one of the kids behind the couch. Don't let these opportunities pass you by, you guys. Be of love and service, man. You know, God will guide us. You know, some magical stuff will happen in this fellowship, you know, in our lives, really. This is all about magic. Believe me, man. Trust me. This is about magic. We shouldn't be doing what we're doing. We shouldn't be alive. So God bless you all, and hope you guys get through this corona thing okay, man. You know, I know it's a lot of fear. You know, lean into the fear, man. Don't let it consume you. Lean into it. You know, learn from it. That's what recovery is all about. No matter what's going on in our lives, we can learn something from it. Don't let it consume you. Aloha.